right, we are back with episode 496 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and my, that was an unusual eclipse.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and ooh, look at this shiny nickel I got. It's so pretty.
And this is Bronstam from Australia, and I always wanted to go on a trip to the South American Italian coast.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah, so, as usual, we are going to be wrapping up our week with the last few news items, and then still a slew of episodic discussions. But first, Edmund, if you could give us a quick disclaimer.
Absolutely. We will talk about just about anything that might have happened, so you will be spoiled. But as ever, especially when we have a buildup of episodes like this, we've given you quite a bit of time to catch up before we do all that.
That's right. And we are going to get right into a handful of news articles here as we wrap up this week's worth of new discoveries. And I'll very quickly go to the first one. I don't want to get into a lot of the details on this, but yeah, apparently ABC has decided to extend the seasons for a few shows. And I'm more curious by the lack of certain shows on this list than the ones that are actually on it. Yeah, so shows like Modern Family and Blackish and The Middle and Grey's Anatomy and Once Upon a Time all got new episodes. I'm noticing Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is not on this list.
Mm-hmm.
Just saying. Anyway. Yeah, and originally it had been reported that even Resurrection had gotten an extra episode, but apparently they changed their minds, which I was more per episode when they have the ratings that they have versus the updated news, anyway. That made a lot more sense.
So what does that bring their seasons to?
I'm not getting into that. A lot of these, I mean, some of them are 23, some are 24, but the fact that Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. you would think would be doing better than some of these shows, but anyway. Once Upon a Time, do they really need more episodes?
Well, you know, I guess it's more advertising money going into the network, so, you know.
Maybe.
Yeah, that's the Disney PR connection going on there.
I guess so.
And I would imagine Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I think may have some budgetary issues in terms of, you know, paying for cloaking technology and that sort of thing. So
I mean, we just got done saying that we kind of like the fact that they weren't. So
yeah,
yeah, maybe it's for the best. Bronstone, if you don't mind taking the next one, I think we'll find it amusing. Or not? Did he leave already? Did we lose Bronstam? All right.
Nope,
Gary,
I'm here.
Oh, there he is.
About that. Okay, so Arrow's Greg Berlanti is developing an Archie Comics drama for Fox. And I can only hope it's going to, every episode is going to have, "My name is Archie."
Well, is it the Archie Afterlife series?
No, but okay, so here's the thing that made this interesting to me is that, okay, so the guy behind Arrow and the Flash is going to bring the Archie comics to TV for Fox. The script is for something called Riverdale. So he's naming it after, okay. The potential series will be set in present day and offer a bold, subversive take on Archie, Betty, Veronica, and their friends.
Subversive Archie?
Yes.
Subversive.
Yeah, Betty and Veronica are the ones in love.
I always knew with that red hair he was a commie.
I'm just thinking this is going to be like, I think someone even described it as Archie by way of Twin Peaks. It's what it feels like. I hope they do this.
Oh, that's yes.
Who killed Jughead? I can see it.
If Betty winds up washing up on a beach wrapped in plastic, I'm done. Throw in the towel now. All right, Edmund, take this last article and kind of leave us off on a better note or less surreal one anyway.
Yes, no, well, we'd talked previously that Sci-Fi is going to be adapting Arthur C. Clarke's Childhood's End as a miniseries, and I think this does speak well for it. They have cast Charles Dance as the ambassador for the Overlords. We don't have, that's kind of the first major casting news. We still have other characters to get cast, but that certainly speaks well of the quality that they are striving for in the series. Of course, given the fact that the overlords are famously don't reveal themselves, it's in fact a huge major plot point in the book. In this case, of course, I'm with Charles Dance. I mean, yes, it's not just the looks; it is the voice as well. So even if we're just hearing him, I'm sure he will bring it. So,
Yes, indeed. All right, well, we are going to go ahead then into our break, and then when we return, we will hit the episodic discussion, so stay tuned. And Bronstom, I know that you're only with us for a short period of time for this show, so we'll give you your last selection here.
Well, we haven't got much time, I say let's get stuck into Arrow.
All right, let's go ahead and do that, and here's the promo.
Where are we going?
You asked me to teach you. Pain is inevitable, and suffering is optional.
What are you doing?
Now we can begin. It's time for my sister to come home.
I'm never coming back to Surfing City.
The truth is the only thing that's going to bring her back.
You will lose her, Oliver, forever.
Thea!
You've come a long way.
Arrow, all new. This Wednesday at 8, 7 Central on the CW.
All right, and promo, please.
Alrighty.
Yeah, please. Something.
Arrow, Arrow Season 3, Episode 3, Corto Maltese. Oliver tries to track down Thea in Corto Maltese as Diggle searches for a missing Argus field operative. Meanwhile, Felicity adapts to her new job.
Okay, that's one way of putting it, I guess. And what would you give this one?
I give this one an 8.
Okay. And Edmund, how about you?
I will go an 8 as well.
Yeah, I think that that sounds. Let's see, is that what I? Yeah, I think I gave it an 8.5, but so about the same. Bronstone, why don't you go ahead and get us started off, just in case you have to cut out.
We had a number of really good introductory elements. I thought like good groundwork for future for stories going forward in the season. The stuff with Thea and Malcolm. It's this sort of like dark twist on what we know Ollie went through, the idea of her, you know, now being of a, you know, suitably badass level within the Arrow universe, and just, you know, essentially getting Malcolm's permission in his own subtle way to go back to Starling City. Or is it still Starling City, or is it officially Star City now?
I think it's in the process of becoming Star City, so...
Yeah.
But yeah, so, you know, and his promise that he'll be back in Starling City pretty soon lays the groundwork for... I mean, it's a complete flip of the dynamic. I mean, her, you know, if she's the one with the big secret, the one that he's, I would assume, going to chip away at the edges of intentionally or unintentionally as the season goes on. And then at the same time, this is easily the most interested I've been in Laurel since possibly the entire show. They're doing well with using this arc, using her grief over what happened to Sarah and all that, to begin transforming her into the Black Canary. But it doesn't necessarily feel like a ham-fisted transformation. It feels like they're writing a good arc, a good reason why she would go from why, you know, she would be angry enough and antsy enough and whatnot to want to be sort of proactive and start doing things. At the same time, making the point that like she's going to need to work a bit to get up to that level.
Yeah, what I really liked about that was maybe it was because I felt like my defense of Laurel in the second season was justified, because she comes out and says directly that when her world fell apart last season, she devolved into drugs and alcohol, and it left her with nothing. It left her completely empty, and now she's been hit again, and she can't go back to that. She has to channel that somewhere else, and she wants to channel it the way that Sarah kind of told or kind of hinted for her to do. So it kind of justifies, even if it wasn't done very well necessarily, but it still justifies what they did with her character last season. And it shows much better how they are kind of planning out these character arcs a lot further in advance than most showrunners will do.
Yeah, and certainly
that's the way it strikes me.
Yeah, absolutely, and it certainly seems like they're starting her off on this arc on a much better footing than they did last season. Even though we've had those instances of where she was able to, and then she even mentions, you know, oh yeah, I've taken some self defense classes. But certainly having her go up against someone who has no compunction and is obviously used to hitting women, as is well established, to have her get taken down that. You know, a whole bunch of pegs right out of the gate, I thought was a very nice way of starting this out. However, you know, brutal and painful it was for her, and certainly avoided what I think would have been a very unrealistic transition, you know, especially after we've seen what Oliver and Sarah went through to get to where they're at, and of course interestingly paralleled with what they revealed about what Thea's been going through in the intervening time.
Yeah, Bronson, how about you and your thoughts on Thea and her kind of the revelations there? Because, I mean, Laurel's not the only character that seems to finally be getting some redemption at this point in terms of how people are perceiving her, because Thea was the other character that everyone kind of hated.
Yeah, but I think they handled Thea a lot better. They have handled Thea a lot better up to this point. I think it's Laurel was mismanaged, and I don't think the actress is doing a particularly good job, and she's really picked up this season, whereas I think Thea has never been a bad presence, even if she's sort of not been a particularly active one. It's the argument that I go back to when people talk about Sansa Stark in Game of Thrones and Song of Ice and Fire, is that she's not a bad character, it's just that she's a passive character. She's not an active participant in the story. She's, she's a good character, three-dimensional, all that sort of stuff, but she's not active in the story. She's there, for the most part, so that we can see the story that's unfolding, the story that's happening to other people. And it's only later in that particular example, much later, unfortunately, that character starts taking some agency. And that's when a lot of people jumped on oh, this character's awesome. And I think Thea, it's a similar case. I don't think she's ever been a particularly bad character. She definitely wasn't one of the most interesting when the show started. And as they've developed her and they've done different things with her, it's still been a case of she's not an active part of what makes the ongoing story, or at least the ongoing story that we're really interested in and invested in, which is, the Arrow and his mission. I think it was a similar kind of thing with Moira. I really hope I got that name right. With the mom. She was always like a fantastic character, and the actress did a great job. But how often was she an important part of the main story? And they took one route with her, which was like, okay, let's take this character out of the show in such a way that, you know, we don't have a character that we're constantly trying to shoehorn into the story, and by taking her out of the equation in this particular way, it feeds into the ongoing story. And it was a really good, it was an excellent departure for the character. It had a lot of weight, it had a lot of meaning, and it really kicked off, a lot of character and story threads. Here they've gone the other way, which is let's figure out a good way to bring that character into the fold. And they didn't even do it the way I would have been expecting half a year ago, which was, let's let her in on the secret and let her help in some capacity. It's like, no, let's have her secretly throw her lot in with the villains, not realizing that it's her brother who's the hero and her boyfriend who's the sidekick. It sets up a really, really good dynamic, and it's a really good way to make that character a more active part of the show, much like what they're doing with Laurel. Although with Laurel, it's a slightly different case. She's trying to get involved in the main... she's trying to be a bigger part of Team Arrow, and they're kind of saying no, because they don't want her to be in the kind of danger that ultimately got Sarah killed and stuff like that. So she's trying to take matters into her own hands. Those are the two standout characters of the episode, Laurel and Thea, which is amazing if you look at where the show was a year ago, a year and a half ago, but it's totally earned, and they do a really good job with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly why this episode, it still works really well. I mean, it's Arrow is a show that, even when it's doing its standard expected type of material, it's still a cut above. And there's a reason why everybody out there seems to feel like Arrow is kind of the standard bearer when it comes to comic book adaptations on TV right now. At least superhero-wise. I mean, obviously, The Walking Dead still is kind of in its own kind of place, too. But there we are.
Yeah, and I just wanted to at least give a mention to the main plot, because even though absolutely the Laurel and Thea stuff was, there's a reason we were focusing on it. But I did also like the Diggle storyline and the way they were integrating. I mean, they're kind of the through thread for all of these different plot lines was the family and how you respond to family, and having Diggle then having his family directly threatened by the operative trying to sell the information. I thought really helped tie things together, and also just really helped to sort of re-emphasize this new situation that Diggle finds himself in, and his new challenge and the people he's going to have to try and protect, presumably through the rest of this season and beyond.
Yeah, definitely. All right, Bronstam, I'm guessing that you need to run.
Sadly, yes.
Okay.
It's been fun.
All right. Well, we will hopefully catch up with you next time then.
Mm-hmm. Take it easy. Right.
See you next week. Okay, in that case, Gary, why don't you go ahead and choose our next topic?
I don't think we've actually talked about him in a while, so let's go for a visit with our doctor.
All right. And we have three episodes here, so let's go ahead and run the first promo.
Hello, Earth. We have a terrible decision to make. An innocent life versus the future of all mankind.
Whatever future humanity might have depends upon the choice that is made right here, right now.
Decision made.
And a recap, please.
Absolutely. We're talking about Doctor Who, Season 8, Episode 7, Kill the Moon. The Doctor and Clara crash land on the moon, where they discover a mining base strewn with corpses and encounter giant, webby spiders.
That's certainly part of it. yeah. What would you give this one?
6.5.
Okay. And how about you, Edmund?
I will go 7.5.
Okay. And I give it an 8. Okay.
Eight.
An 8. All right. Well, Gary, go ahead, since you kind of said that with some degree of incredulity. What specifically kind of didn't work for you in this episode?
Well, even for a Doctor Who episode, the whole science of the episode just had me scratching my head.
Well,
up and down, all over the place, the mass of the moon and all that sort of stuff. I don't even know why they had to go there. Couldn't they just use some sort of attraction force or something like that? You know, if they're actually going to go down the science slide, you know, at least try and make it somewhat authentic. I realize we're talking about a man in a little blue box that goes all over creation, but still, it's just it was a little rough for me to get past some of that stuff. Also, geez, you know, for some reason, you know, this reminded me a little bit of the Waters from Mars episode, but I don't mean that. But that was such a much better episode. This one seemed rather pale in comparison. I didn't feel like. Again, much as I referred to in our last episode when I was talking about you know, The Walking Dead, this almost felt sort of like a stock episode. It didn't seem to push anything forward. We didn't really get any flashbacks for the slightly larger story that they've been presenting that I noticed. And Capaldi, who I thought was getting better in the last episode, seemed a bit flat this episode. I didn't care for his performance, and he was starting to warm up for me, and I was kind of disappointed in that.
Yeah, I will say that my I didn't have a lot of things that I wrapped up in my review for this one, but the thing that I noted as the bad was whole lot of fiction, itty-bitty science.
Yeah.
very little science. I think the only thing that could be called science is the Earth has a satellite called the Moon. That was about as close to science as they got. But I will say, you know, this was the episode that really crystallized for Clara the aspects of this incarnation of the Doctor that she doesn't like a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
If the previous episode was talking about how the Doctor was supposed to be the caretaker for Earth and she was basically his caretaker, this goes completely contrary to that. He basically says, you know what? You guys deal with it. And it was in such a way that felt smug and disingenuous. I mean, he didn't know how it was going to turn out. I don't believe that for a second. It felt like he contrived the whole thing and then was surprised that it didn't go over very well. And it kind of gets back to the fact that the Doctor himself doesn't seem to know who he is right now. So that all being said, Edmund, what do you want to add to my comments and Gary's disappointments?
Yeah,
Than you were to him. So
yeah, basically, what pushed it over for me was the whole putting humanity on the spot at the end. Because yeah, certainly the, you know, I think all, you know, all three of us are you know, space science nuts enough to, you know, where we, yeah, you just have to turn your brain off in terms of what they were presenting earlier. Also, it was, you know, Hermione Norris, who played the main the chief astronaut. I really enjoyed her work on Spooks / MI5, so it was nice to see her again. To a certain extent, I did like them pushing pushing that whole conflict. But at the same time, I also got this sense of, you know, yes, he was putting them in this position, but at the very end, you kind of got the sense that, that yes, he knew which way it was going to go, even though he was supposedly giving them the choice. But in a way, that even still worked for me in terms of them pushing him into a position of being more manipulative and less the sort of white knight champion of Earth that particularly the previous two incarnations were often turning into, that they were sort of hinting at with Capaldi's version. But I enjoyed them putting that conflict in, but even then, as I'm talking it through, it doesn't completely hold together.
No. How to put it? He puts it into humanity's hands. So he basically puts it into Clara and her you know, companions.
Yeah.
Into their hands. They basically ask Earth to give them a vote, which was ludicrous the way that whole thing was played out.
Yes.
And then basically Clara's like, well, screw their vote. I'm doing what I want anyway. And it's like, yeah. Again, Doctor, these are the people you're putting your faith in. You better have known how this is going to work out, because they weren't ready for this. They weren't ready at all. You didn't give them enough time. This was ill-advised. But at any rate, I still enjoyed it. I think I enjoyed it a lot more after Clara basically went off on him, because it kind of justified how I felt that the Doctor was a little out of bounds here. All of that said, I don't know that the next episode did a whole lot to help.
Yes.
Well, let's just go right into the promo for that one.
There were many trains to take the name Orient Express, but only one. In space.
Good morning, everyone. Your goal is to ascertain the foretold's true nature.
I know exactly what this sounds like.
Isn't this exciting?
It's immortal, unstoppable, unkillable.
Can we get a new expert?
Those that bear the foretold stare have 66 seconds to live.
Start the clock.
All right, and Gary, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. We're talking about Doctor Who, Season 8, Episode 8, Mummy on the Orient Express. The Doctor battles a terrifying mummy who is stalking passengers on a train.
Hmm. Okay. What would you give this one?
Well, since it is Season 8, Episode 8, I will give it an 8.
All right. And Edmund?
7.
Okay. Yeah, I'm about the same. I was waffling between a 6.5 and a 7, actually. And I know the question's going to come, why is that? I'm going to say definitively a lot of it was Clara's practically instant reversal of everything that I loved about her going after at the Doctor in the previous episode, and by the end of this episode basically saying, but you know what? Forget all that. I'm still going with you.
Well, you know what your problem is. Did you know
what?
The previous episode was not written for Capaldi?
Oh.
It was an 11th Doctor script they reworked.
What, Kill the Moon or Money on the
Kill the Moon. Really?
Well, maybe that has. It would have been completely out of place for him, though. That's what doesn't make any sense.
Maybe that's why they held it.
It might. But then this really doesn't make any sense. At any rate, that's what kind of pulled it down for me into more of an average episode, is that I liked the mystery end of this as to how that it was resolved. I did like the fact that Clara was once again left in a position of questioning whether or not the Doctor was really doing what was best for all involved, or it was best for him from his point of view, or, you know, basically questioning his judgment, and then him kind of showing that, like, no, I just couldn't tell you what was going on because that was part of the plan.
Well, that's how I feel most doctors are. As we take these adventures, I have a sense that they know. They might not know every little detail, but they have a general idea what's going on in the first place. Why they toy with the companions this way, I still haven't figured out. But I've always felt they have at least an overview of why they've gone to that particular area for what reason. So
I've always been this like, undercurrent with some of the doctors where they kind of enjoy being the superior, you know it all, and they kind of set it up so that they get to be the mentor and kind of show off. And I don't know that Capaldi's incarnation of the Doctor is so much of the show off, so much as that he almost takes it even further than that. There's almost a little bit of an edge of negativity to his assessment of someone who isn't on his level. At the same time, he kind of struggles with why somebody takes it personally. It's almost like he's the Asperger's doctor in some respects, because he's so emotionally detached. He doesn't quite get it. But at the same time, I think that's why this episode worked okay from a plot perspective for me. It's just that it annoyed me that Clara turned it around so fast.
Yes.
The Clara part would not have necessarily been in the original incarnation of whatever the previous episode would have been. I would have hoped not. But it's just the fact that she – maybe make it a couple episodes down the road. But now it becomes a metaphor for her kind of cheating on her boyfriend. It's creepy.
What
bothered me, Edmund? If you want to kind of go off on a different tangent,
No, because that was my biggest issue was after. I mean, over these last few episodes, building up all of these reasons why she would have issues with the Doctor and seeing this darker side of him, and it seemed to be building towards, especially since they've been hammering us on the head with the fact that, you know, yes, Clara's going to leave, to then have her pull this, you know, oh, I'm scared of commitment, and yes, let's go running off around the universe still, just seemed very strange and abrupt, and going against everything that they'd been building up in the previous episodes. You know, because the whole thing with the mummy, and I did like the way they managed to turn what seemed like a bit of one of their less serious episodes of, you know, yes, there's an Orient Express even in space, and then actually dropped this rather menacing villain into it, and having the Doctor have to be at his manipulative best to defeat it at the end. It did seem to be just continuing this arc of the reasons why he might not want to be with the Doctor, and it just seemed completely unjustified at the end when she did that.
Yeah. So Gary, you liked this quite a bit more than the previous episode. Do you have a difference of opinion on how some of these things played out, or did you just like the plot more than some of these situations would have detracted from it?
I like the plot. I liked Capaldi in this episode. I thought I like this sort of sense of the Doctor who has a at least vague idea of the situation. He doesn't know the details per se, or he's got to like almost remember them more so than figure them out. And that sort of worked for me. The problem solving Doctor. I like that sort of motif.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, fair enough. It's not like we gave it a terrible score overall, but we did have a little bit of a difference of opinion there. I'm curious as to the next one, though, and let's go ahead and run that promo.
Oh, that can't be good.
Something nearby is leeching all the external dimensions.
Aliens.
Possibly. Oh, what am I getting? Probably. Whatever they are, they're experimenting. They're testing. They are dissecting. Trying to understand us. Trying to understand...
three dimensions.
Life support failing.
All right, and if you could.
Yes, we're talking about Season 8, Episode 9, Flatline. Clara battles a menace from another dimension and tries to free the entrapped Doctor from a little problem he's having.
And what would you give this one?
Hmm. I'm a little. I will go. I'll go with an 8.
Okay. And Edmund, how about you?
I was thinking of an 8 as well.
And that's what I wound up giving it in my review.
Winner, so, winner, chicken dinner.
Yeah, that, we seem to have finally aligned on this show. Yeah, this is, would be, of course, one of the better scored episodes of the season. Gary, you know, again, two episodes in a row that you seem to like quite a bit. What was it about this one that you liked?
The humor. I like the humor a lot, not just a wise remark or a little snicker of some sort, but, you know, the whole genuine premise of the TARDIS being shrunken in size, I thought was something novel while still communicating with the full-size doctor in the TARDIS. I enjoyed as the actual doorway would get smaller and smaller and get access through the TARDIS.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, from that aspect was quite enjoyable. You know, handing out of the sonic screwdriver was a nice touch as well. And then there's the second half of the movie, or, you know, the Clara hour. you know, she was, you know, very much in control. The doctor did not have a big role in this, and I thought she did a very good job. As we seem to notice after companions are with the doctor for a while, they're usually very capable of solving things on their own, or at least, you know, coming to conclusions. And Clara's proving to be, you know, in a sense, out of the same mold when the companions get these solo episodes, you know, as she was able to save people's lives and keep them alive till the actual, you know, problem got figured out. So in that sense, it was nice to see Clara take control. Some of the rubbing it in the doctor's face, I thought, was a bit much, even for you know, for Clara. While she can be a little bit you know, argumentative, might not be the word, but quick with a comeback, it still seemed a little bit much given the situation. Mm-hmm. Trying to think what else. And also, as a side note, when the TARDIS shrunk down again, and it was just a cube, it looked an awful lot like the Pandorica, didn't it?
There are some people who noticed mm-hmm. that and commented on that. But yeah. It's an interesting possibility that there's a connection there. That's for sure. Considering the what the purpose of the Pandorica was.
Yes.
And we really don't know what the origins of the Pandorica were. So, interesting. Yeah, I mean, you put your finger on a lot of the things that I enjoyed about the episode. I did find it somewhat telling that there were people who didn't like this one because it was so Clara-centric. And I was like, well, this whole season has been Clara-centric. What?
Yes, indeed.
You get what you ask for, guys. I mean, we also asked for a season that was less dominated by the season arc and more devoted to episodic, classic-type adventures. That's what we've gotten. Mm-hmm. Why are you complaining?
Yeah.
But it's because it's people. Edmund, anything to add to what Gary said? Because, like I said, I'm pretty much right on the ball with him on this one.
Yeah, no, well, other than after my just expressed distaste at the end of the previous episode of it, I did kind of joke with myself that, oh, okay, that's why she wants to still hang around with the doctor. She wants to try being the doctor. Now this makes more sense. but yeah, I did love the way they use the whole, yes, the TARDIS is shrinking, but of course it's still much bigger on the inside and he's still full size, and there's that whole image of the TARDIS scuttling along like Thing from the Addams Family was just priceless. You know, and at the same time, I mean, having a very sort of classic Doctor Who concept villain with funky effects and some you know, and puzzles to work out. So yeah, I mean, I agree. It was just a very nice twist on the dynamic, and you know, and unlike some of those bad science-y stuff of Kill the Moon, it you know, it actually still managed to be one wouldn't say realistic, but at least reasonably presented. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, where Kill the Moon felt completely ludicrous with its ignorance of science, this felt, like you said, a lot more like something that they would have come up with back in the classic days, and you just would have gone along with it because it was perfectly acceptable and fun the way that it was being presented. It was kind of chilling in some respects. It was silly in some other respects, especially, you know, the way that the TARDIS was reacting to it. But for me, the real joy was the way that Clara and the Doctor both had to kind of understand each other's point of view throughout.
Yeah.
It was a step in that direction, but it didn't quite... I couldn't give it more than an 8, even though occasionally I wanted to, because there was still that lingering issue of how Clara was basically treating Danny like she was cheating on him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just creepy. Anyway. All right, so we're now up to date on Doctor Who. Let's go ahead and, Edmund, why don't you pick our next topic?
Well, I think we need to finish up with, well, not necessarily for the episode, but we need to finish up with the finale of Manhattan.
Yes, absolutely. Let's go ahead then and run a promo.
We're building an atomic bomb. It'll set off a chain reaction that will explode with the power of 20,000 tons. And then there will never be another war.
They think he's a traitor.
He knew the risks. All that matters is that you are the man to end this war.
What, you're gonna torture me?
Manhattan, season finale, Sunday.
All right, and if you could do the recap, please.
Certainly. Manhattan, Season 1, Episode 13, Perestroika. In the Season 1 finale, Frank is offered a life-changing opportunity. At the same time, the U.S. Army puts Charlie on the hot seat.
Okay, and what would you give this one?
I will give this a 9.5.
All right, and Gary?
I'll go 9 with it.
Okay, and I will give it a 9. So, yes, easily the highest scored episode of the season. Wraps up the season with an 8.1, which is a pretty darn good above average score for a first season of any show.
Yep.
Edmund, why don't you go ahead? The highlights of this particular finale. You gave it the highest marks, so.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, for me, it was, I just found it to be a very beautifully constructed episode. Just the way they started out with Frank borrowing in the closet, making this discovery yes, I guess if I'd really been thinking about it, I might have been able to realize what it was. I think they did do that very well in terms of with all of the other stuff that was then going on and Charlie getting taken in and having all of the stuff that's gone on sort of thrown in his face, and just one of those classic situations of where, no, it didn't actually happen that way, but you can see how it could be interpreted that way, him trying to work his way out of it, and it seeming to be one of those absolutely no-win situations, and then it's circling back to Frank having that conversation with his wife and in fact having the crucial part of it being after she has left the room, even though those listening in didn't realize that, and to really emphasize that, no, this is him having made the decision of, no, this is the way to resolve this, and basically make the self-sacrifice to ensure that the project stays in the hands of as has been emphasized throughout the season, one of the finest minds of his generation. I just thought it was remarkably done of how they just brought all these threads together and all of these the characters' strengths and weaknesses and obsessions and really brought it all home and at the same time gave us this extremely surprising ending and certainly it's one of those endings where it's not a complete cliffhanger. I mean they were pulling all these threads together and finishing them off, but if it had in fact been closing on that final image of Frank being driven away with the hood on his head, I think we would all be railing about yet another series that just went 13 episodes and now we're not going to find out what happens. So. I'm glad that's not the case.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they've already renewed us for the second season, and I think that's good. I'm glad WGN's turning into a good content provider. So,
Yeah, I mean, Gary, would you add anything to what Edmund said? Because, quite frankly, that's pretty much what I enjoyed and felt was the best part of this episode, was just how well they thematically and just overall wrapped up the threads that they introduced, yet still left it in a place where the story was organically moving forward for a second season.
Well, I do have to say, I was taken a little aback by Charlie's revelations. I honestly didn't see them coming, at least not to the extent that they talked about him selling the secrets and having to go through his interrogation. I guess everybody gets to go through one through before the series is over. at least that's the feeling I'm starting to get. And while I realize there were secrets, I'm wondering how accurately this is portraying that this was that paranoid a place as we're sort of getting the sense of. I enjoyed some of the little tidbits, like, you know, of course all the rooms are bugged. That's why they go outside. That's why Frank's always outside. I said, oh, that's, you know, they were full of nice little touches. But I have to say, I was happy with where the season ended. I don't think it could have been a series finale, so I'm glad that they did get renewed as well.
Yeah. Could you imagine if this was the end of the series?
Yes. Yeah, and I would have been railing.
Yeah, thankfully, like you said, WGN has turned out to be, at least have started off on a really good footing with shows of remarkably different content type, yet still really committing fully to doing the best that they possibly can with the shows that they have put out. So I'm hoping that the second seasons will live up to the first seasons and that future content will also live up to it.
Oh, I agree. And that's a hard thing for a network to do, to hit different genres and do it even reasonably well. And, you know, they're doing it. So yay them.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Gary, why don't you go ahead and pick our next topic?
Oh my gosh, have we not gone to that little burg of Sleepy Hollow in a while? I think we haven't.
No, we haven't. So I think that sounds like a great suggestion. Let's go ahead. We have three episodes here. We'll probably round out this episode with those. So let's go ahead and get to it. First promo.
Nick Hawley?
We endeavor to learn what you know of a rare coin.
Why is he talking like that?
You get used to it. Some say it has powers to cause its holder to betray his deepest loyalties. Henry has brought one of those same coins to Sleepy Hollow.
Perhaps to turn the tide of this war in his favor.
It reveals what's already there. The darkness in all of you.
My sister's gonna try to kill me. Don't do it.
All right, and recap, please.
Yes, we're talking about Sleepy Hollow, Season 2, Episode 3, The Root of All Evil. A violent bank robbery puts Ichabod and Abby on a quest for a mysterious silver coin that possesses unusual power. Meanwhile, Captain Irving faces a difficult choice involving his family, and the bond between the Mills sisters is tested.
Mm-hmm. So, let's see. What would you give this one, do you think?
I would give this one an 8.5.
All right, and Edmund, how about you?
I will go an 8.
All right. Henry gave this one an 8.5 as well, and I would also give it an 8. So, yeah, a fairly consistently strong episode from all of our points of view. I know that Henry, his main thing was that... Well, he just really put it down to how well the character interactions are being portrayed when there are these key plot points that are being dropped. It's not just that they're dropping these plot points and then moving forward. It's that the characters are being given the time and the scope to actually sit and talk about what this is meaning to them. It's not just happening, it's happening to these people, and these people are having the opportunity to react in the story. And it means that we're kind of engaging more with Ichabod and Abby, and that's probably why all this ludicrous stuff that's going on is just... It's a lot more palatable, because the characters are people that we enjoy watching. At least that's what... I mean, this episode, that's what I took away from it, is that... Yeah, the plot itself, it feels ripped a little bit right from Grimm, but at the same time, it worked pretty well for Sleepy Hollow. Anyway, Gary, what would you add?
Well, I've always been a sucker for stories involving these, I don't know how you want to refer to them. I'll call them Judas coins. And typically, they're usually done reasonably well. There's a little bit of awe and, I don't know if respect's the right word, but, you know, definitely some sense of their importance or their power. And I felt they balanced it well, and I enjoyed it oddly for a, you know, for a gimmick of the week. So, so that was nice. I also enjoyed the whole the Captain Irving scenes in the sanitarium with I guess we refer to him as War. I like how he's really backed into a corner with apps pretty much, or what seems to be no choice at all. So no, this fired well for me on a lot of different cylinders, and that's why I ranked it as high as I did. The characters are spot on. These are people that know each other and are used to talking to each other, and you feel that in this. The writing's really tight.
Edwin, what'd you add?
Yeah, no, I think it was a case of taking as Gary said, a somewhat conventional trope of this coin, but really using it to bring out the characters, both John Noble being as nasty and insidious as he was, and then of course the way the coins are bringing out certain traits in Jenny and putting the sisters at odds, and it was just a really nice way of as we've said, just delving more into the characters while also still serving the plot and serving the Horsemen of War, introduce tensions and conflicts and trying to drive the team apart. And certainly in the case of Captain Irving, I mean, seeming to do it extremely well. And, it was very, very nice to see them, not this show ever really does that, but not stretch out the whole thing of, he doesn't realize his lawyer is the horseman, but just to bring that right to a head and put him in a very nasty situation.
Yes, very true. All good points and all good elements of this particular episode and why the season continues to work. Let's go ahead and run the next promo and see if the luck continues.
A missing child.
She was lured by a creature of legend.
The Pied Piper. One man with deadly skill.
Why would an assassin target a little girl?
The evil we face is real.
Shall be victorious or defeated together.
Sleepy Hollow, next Monday at 9/8 Central.
And Gary, if you could go ahead and give the recap.
Absolutely. We're talking about Sleepy Hollow Season 2, Episode 4, Go Where I Send Thee. Abby and Ichabod's search for a missing child leads to the discovery of a demonic Pied Piper whose ties to the Tots family goes back centuries.
Okay, and what would you give this one?
I would give it a 7.
Okay. And Edmund?
I will go 6.5.
All right. And as I go over to Henry's review on dognetwork.com, he gave this one an 8. And I would probably give it a 7.5.
Okay.
So, a bit of a spread there, oddly enough. Edmund, yes. 6.5. I think that is the lowest that you've rated or scored an episode of Sleepy Hollow yet.
Yes, and
what did it work for you here?
I will lay all of that score at the feet of Mr. Hawley.
Hawley?
Mr. Hawley, our new surfer dude, rogue, villain, etc. Yes. He's not a villain in the horseman sense, but anyway. After his introduction in the previous episode, him then still returning to take such a large role in this episode, and to my mind, it's just feeling extremely forced, and the character and the interact after what we were just talking about in the previous episode of how well they were sort of using the plot lines to develop the characters and the interactions, and it feels like they're trying to shoehorn him in there, and he to me feels like a refugee from Hawaii 5-0 or something. That was the part that just throughout this episode just was really rubbing me the wrong way, and just took me out of enjoying what other stuff might have been going on in it. But I will leave you guys to talk about what might have actually been going okay in this episode.
Gary, why don't you go ahead and start the rebuttal?
I enjoyed the assault in the woods lair. I don't know how you refer to that little underground sort of basement or storage area. I liked how they went to go confront him there. That was fun. As we've often complained about this thing, Ichabod seems to know everything as he's able to find the little piece of the flute and automatically be able to relate it. I thought that the Pied Piper was a much older historical type of not historical, but a much older story that predated even the Revolution. So to find out it planted in the Revolution did lose a little bit for me, but at the same time, it worked as a nice little episode for me. I thought it was good, and mainly I have to credit it to what we were talking about the last episode. You know, these two characters, are a nice little buddy team at this point. They're humorous, everything from some of the driving episode parts to the quips they make back and forth with each other. It's a joy to watch the two actors interact in these roles. So I'm starting to reach the point where they can talk about a lot and I'll give them leeway.
Let's see. I mean, this one, I guess it did kind of devolve to a few story tropes that are a bit familiar, but at the same time, I felt like it was still unique enough that it worked. And of course, Irving just wasn't very... He had some really interesting flash forwards that worked for me, but Holly, I guess he doesn't annoy me quite as much as he does you, Edmund. Mm-hmm. he feels a little shoehorned in, but I'm not sure yet. I almost feel like we need to see what he ultimately comes to mean to the story before I really come to a judgment on it, because if I wanted to be entirely cynical, I would think that this was the network pressuring them to add someone that would expand their demographic a little bit. But I'm like, but aren't most of the people that are going to go for Howley kind of already into Ichabod? So
I would think, yes, exactly.
I would think, right? But I don't know, because it is a little bit of a kind of standard character type, but at any rate,
I will just mention that to what Gary was saying, I will give the writers credit that I think there was at least a throwaway line in there about, no, it's not that Pied Piper, it was just, or just a different variation on it. But
right,
yeah. And what was more amusing to me was after all of this, yes, he knows everybody in the Revolution, and he's this musician who can just pick up this instrument and start tootling away on it. So just more of the hidden talents of Ichabod Crane.
Look, Ichabod Crane it turns out to be literally the most important person in all of history. Just accept it.
Yes.
Someone on the writing staff is a huge, American Revolution era fan and is Mary Suing the hell out of the show with Ichabod.
Yes.
That's all I can say. All right. Okay, final episode we're going to discuss is the most recent one, and let's go ahead and run that promo.
Put your hands up.
Turn around slowly.
The restless spirit haunts the site of her tragic suicide.
It's a matter of life and death.
Monsters, creatures, it's a weird time.
All right, and Gary, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. We're talking about Sleepy Hollow Season 2, Episode 5, The Weeping Lady. An undead weeping lady in Sleepy Hollow is actually a woman from Ichabod's past who's bent on destruction. Meanwhile, Katrina and Ichabod discover disturbing news about each other, and Abby is surprised by some flirtatious encounters.
Hmm, okay. And what would you give this one?
I will have to abstain. I did not get to see this one this week.
Oh, okay. Plot twist. all right. Edmund, what would you give it?
I will give it a 7.5.
All right. Henry gave this one an 8. And I also would give it an 8. I enjoyed it quite a bit. All right. We'll try not to spoil too much for you, Gary.
just go for it. I do. Our listeners deserve it. Go ahead.
Okay. The thing that worked for me the most in this episode was fleshing out the backstory for Ichabod and Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
Katrina finally did something in this episode. And not only that, but the secrets that we learned about her were not as positive as one might have assumed they would be,
mm-hmm.
including Ichabod. And I like the fact that this kind of seemingly straightforward situation is not nearly as straightforward as all that. As far as Katrina working with Abraham and being the spy and supposedly the completely virtuous person that Ichabod thought that she was in this whole deal, as if their history was not complicated enough. Let's just put it that way. That said, there are a few things that kept it from being even higher, and frankly, I think that for me, it's because I would have much rather seen more of Caroline than more of Holly.
Yes, exactly.
because this episode is where I felt like he was completely out of place versus the previous one. He just comes out of nowhere in this story, it seems. Where at least in the previous episode, there was some connection because of the artifact that was, I guess, at the heart of it.
Right.
The Pied Piper and all that. Here it's just kind of like, yeah, let's just throw him in there.
Mm-hmm.
Just because we can.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of those cases where, I was giving my actual, that was my actual reaction during the episode before I'd seen this one, but I think in terms of ratings, it was more because of the combined weight of these two episodes as far as my reaction to Holly. So, because certainly in this case, I did really like the way they played up finally threw a little wrench into this seemingly perfect marriage and relationship between Ichabod and Katrina, and I thought set it up extremely well with Caroline being sort of such an annoying character in the flashbacks and just really setting us up to you know this is some vengeful spirit who really needs to get taken down, and then to have it all turn around that the only reason she's in that situation is because of what Katrina did, and because let's not forget Katrina is a witch. So I thought it was a very nice way of introducing that complication. But then again, the way they're just insisting on Holly being apparently part of the team, or at least a ongoing presence, it was just bringing up all of my bad reactions from the previous episode.
Yeah, I think that he's still kind of that. My jury is out. Although in this episode, I did feel like he was a detraction, but a very small one. Thankfully, it still comes down, thankfully, to Ichabod and his whole past, which is really the strength of it. And I gotta say that. The guy who plays Ichabod, I think is Tom Meisen.
Tom Meisen.
Meisen. He must have so much fun in this role.
Yes.
When he gave that crow that look of that like side-eyed look, it's so ludicrous. It's you're watching it and you're just like, he's got to know how just over the top his character is, and he just plays it so straight.
Yes, absolutely.
it's probably, like I said, the one reason that this show works is right there. And yeah, the fact that this then took a character that has that layer to it and really played on the emotional side of just the heartache of everything for him and the difficulty of it and the flashbacks with him and Mary in particular, showed a side of him that I don't think we've seen before, and I kind of liked that. I'm surprised that he didn't run into like seven different really well-known Revolutionary War figures while walking down the road with Mary, but yes. Yeah, you know, you gotta back off on that a little bit here and there. But yeah, this was one of the better episodes, for me at least, this season. In fact, if I look, this might have been my top score. Well, it's up there. It's not the top score, but it certainly is on par with some of the episodes I enjoyed the most for the series. But yeah, the series continues to be just rocking it for me, so there you go. Any last thoughts then on Sleepy Hollow?
No, not really.
Okay. Works for me. All right. Well, before we wrap up, there are a couple shows that we will get to. I swear we will, because we did hold off on Supernatural because we definitely want to get Bronstum and his opinions on that one.
Absolutely.
And while the 100 did start this past week, we just didn't have time to include it. And but Edmund and I will delve into it, I'm sure. And, of course, there's our usual quick hits, and we'll just go ahead and kind of double up on some of those for next time. But I think otherwise we have caught up quite a bit this week, and we may finally be getting some relief on our backlog.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.